Latin phrases you should know. Well, part of a classical English literature and Latin seminar needs to be Latin. A lot of people are terrified at the concept of Latin, but we shouldn't be, because we all know quite a bit of Latin. So what Latin words can you think of? Audio, I hear. Video, I see. Exit, I leave. There's a whole lot of Latin that's in our languages, and you'll find even more. From the Middle Ages until about the middle of the 20th century, Latin was a central part of man's schooling in the West. Along with logic, rhetoric, and grammar, Latin was then called grammar. It was included as part of the trivium, the foundation of all medieval liberal arts education. You had to understand logic, rhetoric, meaning debate, and grammar. In fact, entrance qualifications for universities used to be you had to be able to debate in Latin or you couldn't enter university. Today, they have remedial English for people into university, and they need remedial English for some of the professors and lecturers too. So you can see that change is not necessarily progress. From Latin, all scholarships flowed until it was truly the gateway to the life of the mind as the bulk of scientific, religious, legal, philosophical literature was written in the language of Latin until about the 16th century. To immerse yourself in classical and humanistic studies, Latin was a must. Now, again, the term humanistic could derail you, because in the last century, humanism has become a very negative word. But, for example, when I go around different monuments in Europe, you'll see something like Geneva, outside Grossmünster Church, in Zurich, there is a monument to Ulrich Zwingli, the great reformer, and it puts there, and of course it's written in Latin, because that was what almost all old monuments was written in, it was the universal language of educated people, and it said reformer and humanist. Now, of course, for a 20th century person or 21st century persons, how can you call a man who is a reformer a humanist? Well, it meant he studied the humanities back then. It's gotten a very negative, secular, atheistic, revolutionary, anti-Christian identity in more recent times. But 5 centuries ago, to be a humanist was not necessarily to me that you're anti-Christian or anti-biblical. And so the humanities was studying effectively liberal arts, which wasn't liberal in the sense we think today. So we've got to realize language can change. Grammar schools in Europe, and especially in England, were Latin schools. A grammar school is another word for a Latin school. Grammar was synonymous with Latin. The first secondary schools established in the United States of America by the Puritans, well, it was a Latin school as well. So, for example, primer, first. Folia, leaves. Alba, white. Hence, an albino, for example. But beginning in the 14th century, writers started to use the vernacular, meaning their own language, whether it was Saxon, English, or German, and so on, which slowly chipped away at Latin's central importance in education. When Martin Luther met with and debated Van Eck, for example, they were debating in Latin. This is what educated people do. They debated in Latin. It was understood you could come from Italy, you could come from England, you could come from Germany, but you could always converse in Latin because all educated people knew Latin at that time. This trend for English language learning accelerated in the 19th century, and schools shifted from turning out future clergymen to graduating businessmen who would take their place in an industrialized economy. An emphasis in liberal arts slowly gave way to what was considered more practical education in reading, writing, and arithmetic, what they call the three R's. Although you notice there is a W before writing and there's an A before arithmetic, but anyway, they call them the three R's, reading, writing, arithmetic. While Latin had been dying a slow death for hundreds of years, it still had a strong presence in the schools until the middle of the 20th century. But beginning in the 1960s, college students demanded that the curriculum be more open, inclusive, and less Eurocentric. And so to teach Latin was called racist. It wasn't that long ago that you could not study theology at, for example, Baptist Theological College without mastering Hebrew and Greek. But that had to be dispensed with somewhere along the line because that was considered racist. Law, you had to study Latin to be able to be a lawyer, but that's also been dispensed with in this country because that's considered Eurocentric. It's another word for racist. Among their suggested changes was eliminating Latin as a required course for all students. To quell student protest, universities began to slowly phase out the requirement to study Latin. And because colleges stopped requiring Latin, many high schools in America stopped offering Latin classes too. However, I'm from Rhodesia, and we pride ourselves on being more English than English, and Latin was considered essential to education. And I remember asking, why aren't we studying Afrikaans or Matabele? Why are we studying Latin? We need Latin to be educated in. The teacher was just astounded anyone could ask such a dumb question. While it's no longer a requirement for a man to know Latin to get ahead in life, it's still a great subject to study. Even if you're well out of school yourself, there's a myriad of good reasons why you should still consider obtaining at least a rudimentary knowledge of the Latin language. Knowing Latin can improve your English vocabulary. While English is a Germanic language, Latin has strongly influenced it. Most of our prefixes and some of the roots of our common English words are derived from Latin. Just take veritas, which is truth, and that's, in fact, Harvard's motto, although I don't think they live by it. Veritas, in fact, a university, a company of the truth. Uni, company, truth, veritas. So a university is a company of the truth. Consider these Latin words. Micro means small. Do you use the word micro anywhere? Macro means large. Don't we have a shop? Let's call it. Iso, the same. Topos, place, like topography is the study of places. Poly, many, like polygamy, many wives. Polytheism, many gods. Mono, like monotheism, one god. Monogamy, one wife. Saccharin, sugar. They're providing an alternative to sugar called saccharin. Ossi, having a specific quality. Co, together, like company, congregation. Coordinate, all that. Add to others. Pole, end of an axis. Consider this, aqua, water. So we get an aquarium and we get an aquamarine. Audi, hearing, listening, sound. So we have an auditorium. We have auditory and we have audio, all coming from Latin. And then you get act, grow, increase, like augmentation. Avi, a bird. So you get an aviary and you get aviation. It's not an English word as such. It's actually a Latin word. Ben and bon, good and well. So for your benefit, benign, even a bonus, these are good and well. By, too, like binocular, bigamy. Brev, brief, short, like you have abbreviation. Why is abbreviation such a long word? Brevity. Think of rupt, which means break, from rompere or ruptus. Corrupt, erupt, to burst forth. Rupture, to break. Disrupt, to cause disorder. Abrupt, sudden. Bankrupt, having no money. He's broke. Interrupt, to cause a break in the flow. So all comes from the Latin rupt. Or take eu, which is in Latin good. So euphemism, a nice way to say something that's bad, like collateral damage, killing civilians. Saturation bombing, strategic bombing. Genocide of whole cities. Terminate, murder. And you get a euphony, or pleasant sound. Eulogy, praises, normally for the dead. Euphoria, a feeling of well-being. Euthanasia, mercy killing. Eugenics, breeding for racial improvement. Eureka, I found it. So all comes from the word of you, or good. There's a whole lot of different common Latin roots. Everything that comes along, I mean, right down to script, for example. It's a lot of it. Now, just consider the difference between the Anglo-Saxon and the Latin. Ask is Anglo-Saxon. Inquire is Latin. Meet is Anglo-Saxon, but encounter is Latin. To eat, to consume. Belly, abdomen. That's a Latin word. You speak about a flood in Saxon, but inundate is Latin. Drink, well, Latin is imbibe. Free or emancipate. Emancipate, again, is the Latin word for free. To lie or to prevaricate. I mean, the amount of times people speak about him prevaricating, which is the same thing as saying he's lying. Stay or remain. Bid, command. Command is a Latin term. Bless or consecrate is just a Latin term for bless. A bug in English, but an insect is again a Latin term. To build or to construct, to start or to commence. And so you can see all over we've got these different terms, like a child is English, infant is Latin. Deem, English, consider is Latin. Pick is English, select is Latin. Help is English, assist is Latin. Eastern is English, Oriental is Latin. Earth, English, terrain, Latin. Rattle, English, vibration is Latin. First is English, primary. So you have a primary school. It used to be they might have taught Latin, for example, at a primary school. Ban, prohibit is the Latin. Green or verdant, verdant pastures, that's green pastures. Good or beneficial is the Latin term. Fast, or in Latin, rapid. Now, you can see the main Romance languages would be Spanish, Portuguese, French, Italian, Romanian. And you can see how they've got their word for sun, solace, soul, and we have sun. Homo is Latin for man. Body, corpus, is again the Latin term. Moon, luna. Luna is just the Latin term for moon. Night, nox. Well, bene, or beneficial. Well, bene. Year, annus. And good, bonus, life, vita. You've heard of vitality and all of that sort of thing. So, but you can see how English is significantly different. We've got some connections, but plainly, if you know Latin, you can guess when you're dealing with Spanish, Portuguese, French, Italian, Romanian. So Latin, 99% or 90 to 95% of French is Latin. Italian is 90 to 95% Latin, as is Portuguese, Spanish, and Romanian. And so you can see how the Latin has influenced a lot of different continental Romance languages, all the way down to Portugal, France, Latin, all the way to Dalmatia, Sardinia. So here you can see the dark countries are Romance languages solely, and then the lighter, darker blue is Romance language co-official. The light Roman Empire Latin limit. You see, Latin didn't manage to get much past the Rhine River because the German army defeated them decisively time and again. Teutonwald Forest, 9 BC, for example, very major. And England, of course, you can see what's at the end there, Hadrian's Wall, and north of it, the Picts and the Scots, who were too wild for the Romans to manage to subjugate them. So Scottish and German managed to avoid Latin influence because of them keeping the Roman army out. But you can see our language is affected by Latin because the Romans civilized the Britons, they said, for a few centuries. By some estimates, 30% of English words derive from the ancient language of Latin. By knowing the meaning of these Latin words, if you come across a word you've never seen before, you could make an educated guess as to what it means if you know some basic Latin when you're in continental Europe. Knowing Latin can improve your foreign language vocabulary, because much of the commonly spoken Spanish, French, Italian comes from vulgar Latin. Vulgar Latin just meaning common. Doesn't mean it's bad in Latin. You'll be surprised by the number of Romanic words that are pretty much the same as their Latin counterparts. Many legal terms are still in Latin. Nolo contendere. What does that mean? No contest. Cavat impetor. Cavat impetor means buyer beware. The buyer is responsible to see that the product is in good state. You're not meant to buy a car and take it without first test driving or checking, knowing, looking under the hood and knowing that it's safe, and so on. So cavat impetor means buyer beware. Do you know what these words mean? These are common legal words. You see regularly things like alibi, presence elsewhere, ipso facto, by the fact itself, and per se, by itself, pro forma, as a matter of form. Mala fides, bad faith. Bona fides, good faith. Mala prohibita, prohibited by law. Mala in se, wrong in itself. Res gestae, the subject matter. Lex scriptura, well, scripta, lex scripta, the written law. These are just a few Latin terms. While strides have been made to translate into plain English these legal terms, you still see these Latin phrases thrown to legal contract. They will talk endlessly about locus stanti and affidavit and bona fides and all the way through between de facto, de jure, habeas corpus, ultra vires, and so on. To be an educated citizen and consumer, you do need to know what these terms mean. If you plan on going to law school, you will need Latin. You'll run into it all the time, particularly when reading older case law, and that's part of the problem. If you're dealing with history, you get to monuments, and the monument's only description is in Latin. That frequently happens. You get to schools, and their motto is in Latin. You get countries, and their motto is in Latin, and so on. And if you don't know Latin, you're going to struggle. Knowing Latin can give you more insight into history and to literature, because Latin was the lingua franca of the West for over 1,000 years. So just think of something like civis. We get, well, citizen, community, civic service, civilian, lex, or legas, law, legal, that's where we get our term of legislature. A manus is a hand, so a manual is the same word as a handbook. So we talk about a handbook or a manual, it's the same thing. Manual is English. Manual is actually from the Latin, whereas handbook would be English. Militare is to serve as a soldier, so you get the military and you get the militia, again, Latin. Portare, to carry, so you get a portable or porter, that's old-fashioned. Unus, one. America speaks about being united, unus. Urbs comes from city, so a suburb or urban is from the concept of a city. Funny now that we distinguish between a city and a suburb, but urban and suburb come from the same concept. Verbum, word, verbal, verbatim. Consequently, much of our history, science, and great literature was first recorded in Latin. Reading these classics in the original language can give you insights you might have otherwise missed by consuming it in English. Moreover, modern writers, and by modern we mean starting of the 17th century, after the Reformation, they often pepper their words with Latin words and phrases without offering a translation because they reasonably expected the reader to be familiar with it. And so you'll get regularly in the writings of Luther and Zwingli, they will put there these Latin terms that there's no explanation, there's no footnote. You've got to know what that Latin word means or be able to look it up. Now, this is true of great books from even just a few decades ago. Dickens throws Latin words in as well without explanation. This is less common these days, which isn't a hopeful commentary on the direction of public literacy. It's the trouble is people now just don't understand what things mean. Not having a rudimentary knowledge of Latin will cause us to miss out on fully understanding what the writer meant to convey. So here's a few lists of Latin words and phrases to help pique your interest in learning this classical language. It's not exhaustive by any stretch of imagination, but here's some common Latin words and phrases which you still see today, which should boost our overall cultural literacy. We've also included some virile sayings, aphorisms, mottos that can inspire greatness or remind us of important truths. Perhaps you'll find a Latin phrase you can adopt as your personal motto, like Semper Fi, meaning always faithful, which happens to be the motto of the Marines. Carpe Diem. This comes from a poem of Horace, Seize the Day, or Seize the Moment, encouraging individuals to live life to the fullest today without expectation tomorrow. You aren't sure about tomorrow, you've got today, make the most of today. Carpe diem, seize the moment. Cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. This comes from the writings of philosopher René Descartes. Vini, vidi, vici. I came, I saw, I conquered. These are the words uttered by Roman Emperor Julius Caesar, and he's referring to Gaul when he took what today is France. He came, he saw, he conquered. Then from Pliny the Elder, you've got in vino veritas. In wine there is truth. What he means is when people are drunk, they'll often say what they really mean. Huh. This followed up with the in aqua sanitas, in water there is health. Again, thinking of a sanatorium, it's a place for your health. I don't think people always use that sense these days. But so in water there's health, but in wine you could get the truth. Somebody might be foolish enough to say what they're really thinking under the influence of too much wine. Et tu, Brute, you too, Brutus. These famous last words of Julius Caesar, immortalized by Shakespeare's play, are often used poetically to designate any form of the utmost betrayal. This was effectively the adopted son, most trusted friend of Julius Caesar. He also stuck the knife and the dagger. You too, Brute. Et tu, Brute. Or, e pluribus unum. See, that is on any seal of the United States Mercury. You'll even see it in American dollar notes. Out of one, many. So, from diversity, becoming one nation. At least that was the plan at the beginning. Ad infinitum. Just have to think of Toy Story, to infinity and beyond. Which is actually impossible to go beyond infinity. But this describes something that goes on and on, seemingly endlessly. So you can speak about ad infinitum, or ad nauseum, some people would say. Ad astra per aspera, to the stars through difficulties. Through troubles and tribulation, we can attain to the highest. Or de facto. In Latin, de facto means from the fact, and is used in English to distinguish what is supposed to be the case from what is actually the reality. So that may be de jure, but this is de facto. This is the way it really is, as opposed to the ideal. In toto, meaning all or entirely, in total, in toto. Ipso facto, by the fact itself, commonly used and misused term, denotes when something is true by its very nature. This is true ipso facto. Lawyers particularly like to throw those sort of words out. Tabula rasa, a clean slate, denotes something or someone not affected by experiences and impressions. So you might say a baby is born tabula rasa, or somebody comes into a situation with a clean slate. They've got no previous impressions, no prejudices, and so on. Terra firma. The less terror, the more... The less terror, the more terror, actually. So you want to be on land. You're in a storm and sea, or you're struggling to swim through the sea. You get to land, you've got terra firma. You've got firm ground under your feet. You feel security and safety. So terra firma. Can think of pilots that often speak about feet wet, meaning they're flying over water. Feet dry, they're now flying over land. It's the concept of, I feel safer when I'm on solid ground. Mea culpa, I am guilty, my fault. To admit your own guilt or wrongdoing, this Latin phrase means my fault. Sadly, today it's been corrupted into my bad in Americanese, but mea culpa sounds so much more educated and cultured. Persona non grata. This would often be a stamp on people's passports, persona non grata, meaning unacceptable person. You're no longer welcome in a social or business situation. In fact, I've had persona non grata stamped on an application to visit Zimbabwe because of my reports on some of the atrocities. In situ. If something happens in situ, it means it happens in place or it happens on site. In situ. In vitro is not a modern term, it's an ancient term. It means literally in glass. Any biological process that can occur in a laboratory, and yes, they did have laboratories back hundreds of years ago, rather than the body or natural setting, could be called in vitro. So they speak about in vitro, that's in the glass. And then you get in vivo, within the living. So these are the two main common forms of experimentation. You either test in a test tube or you test on animals. Obviously, testing on animals is immoral. That's why we've got groups like Society Against South Africa, against South African Association Against Painful Experiments in Animals, SAPIA. Antebellum. It means before the war. Now, this could be before any war, like before the Roman Civil War. But in America, antebellum means before the war between the states, before the War of Northern Aggression, before what they call the Civil War. And of course, in War and Peace would be before Napoleon invaded Russia and so on. Sick. Normally found in brackets, S-I-C. It means when you're quoting a statement that you know that there's a spelling error, grammatical error, or something out of the ordinary, which you don't believe, but You're including it just to show you, you're including the quote as it was found. In other words, it's not my error. This is the error in the quotation that I'm quoting it. Such as, you know, Cyril Rinpoche said that he's honest and sick, something like that. You know, you don't believe it, but you're quoting it. Id est, i.e. We use i.e. all the time, and it stands for id est. That is in English, but i.e. doesn't translate to that t-i. That's not the same thing. So what we're using is, again, a Latin term. That is. And we will often say this at i.e. That is. So sometimes we actually use it in verbal speech, not just in written. Deus ex machina. In direct translation, this means God out of a machine. It harkens back to ancient Greek and Roman plays when the plot would become so tangled and confusing, the writers would simply bring in a god lowered by a pulley system, the machine, who'd wrap it all up. And today, it's still used in literature to describe a plot where an artificial or improbable means of resolving the conflict is used. And so, if you're reading Movie Guide by Ted Baer, he'll regularly speak about Deus Ex Machina. Like, they wrapped up the convoluted plot with an absolutely improbable, ridiculous, you know, how does this, whether it's a storm, an accident, or whatever it is, that somehow just resolved the situation. And it's as though they didn't have the imagination to work out a decent solution to the problems and plot that they set up. Exempla gratia, which now we put down EG. EG means example. But where do you get EG out of example? I mean, why is it not EX? Again, using the Latin exempli gratia. So a lot of our abbreviations come from Latin. For the sake of example, and if you see it in a sentence, it should be followed by examples. E.g., you've got to give the examples. Et cetera, often abbreviated to ETC, and the others, denotes a list that you could continue to make, but for the sake of brevity, you're wrapping things up with a simple et cetera. Presumably the person knows what you mean. Ex libris, you see this in some people's books, maybe even a stamp or a label, meaning from the library of, which indicates probably please return. Ibidem, often just put ibid, in research writing in the same place, so that if you've already quoted your source, Institutes of Christian Religion, then the other quotes ibid with the page number, ibid and so on. And that just saves you having to cite the same source over and over, just put ibid. Improvidus, apto quod victim. Improvise, adapt, and overcome. Another good Latin phrase. Now, here's an important Reformation concept. Simul justus et peccator. By whose righteousness will we be judged? At the very heart of the gospel is explained in Martin Luther's Latin phrase, simul justus et peccator. And if any formula summarizes the essence of the Reformation view of salvation, it's this little formula. Simul is where we get the English word simultaneous from, at the same time, and justus, the Latin word for justice or just and righteous. And so with this formula, Luther's saying, in our justification, we are one and the same time righteous and just and sinners. Now, if he would say that we're at the same time in the same place and the same relationship just and sinners, that would be a contradiction in terms. But that's not what he's saying. He's saying from one perspective, in one sense, we are just. But another sense, from a different perspective, we are still sinners. How he defines us is simple. In and of ourselves, under the analysis of God's scrutiny, we still have sin, we still are sinners. But by imputation and by faith in Jesus Christ, whose righteousness is now transferred to our account, then we are considered just or righteous. This is at the very heart of the gospel. Will I be judged in order to get into heaven by my righteousness, or will I into heaven by the righteousness of Christ? If I had to trust my own righteousness to get to heaven, I would be completely and utterly in despair of any possibility of ever getting redeemed. No hope. But when we see the righteousness that is ours by faith in the perfect righteousness of Christ, then we see how glorious is the good news of the gospel. The good news is simply this: I can be reconciled to God, I can be justified by God, not on the basis of what I did, but on the basis of what has been accomplished for me by Christ. At the heart of the gospel is this double imputation. My sin is imputed to Christ. His righteousness is imputed to me. In this twofold transaction, we see that God, who does not overlook sin, who does not compromise his own integrity with our salvation, but rather punishes sin fully and in reality after it's been imputed to Jesus, he retains his own righteousness. God is just, but he is also merciful. He's both the just and the justifier. So my sin goes to Jesus. His righteousness comes to me in the sight of God. Veritas, truth. Veritas vos liberabit. The truth shall make you free. Or, atrox melior dulcisma veritas mendacis. The bitter truth is better than the sweetest lies. Or, ecclesia reformata reformanda est. The church having been reformed is still to be reformed. The work of reformation is never over. Semper reformata, or continuous reformation. The battle cries of the Protestant Reformation, mobilized by Luther, rallied around these great battle cries. Solus Christus, Christ alone is the head of the church. Sola Scriptura, Scripture alone is the ultimate authority. Sola Gratia, salvation is by the grace of God alone. Sola Fide, salvation is received, or justification is received by faith alone. Soli Deo Gloria, everything is to be done for the glory of God alone. And you get that on our 1 rand coins. Throughout South Africa, amazing that we still have all that. Everything is to be done for the glory of God alone. Soli Deo Gloria, it's on our 1 rand coins, and it's also on the tomb of Andrew Murray when you go to Wellington, outside the church here. Soli Deo Gloria. It's a lot smaller coin than it used to be. We used to have a nice big 1 rand coin when it still had some silver in it. But these five solas are the battle cries of the Reformation, and they're all in Latin. So there's a lot of key concepts, thoughts that come through in Latin. Take, for example, nulla tenaci in via est via. For the tenacious, no road is impossible. You can do it. So keep calm and study Latin. Any questions, comments, additions, corrections?
Uni,
does
uni mean one? Or what does uni mean?
Uni is one.
Yes. So like uni versus one
verse,
or uni
versus. That's right.
Is one.
Yes. Uni veritas would be uni, yes, but in this sense, the uni is more like a company or
okay.
A unity of truth.
Okay.
So university means one or a company or just there is only one truth and it can be known. So this is both one truth, university or uni veritas, and also a company of truth. Both would be a good translation of that. Uni, one or united or a company. You've got all sorts of interesting things like tempus fugit, time flies. I don't know how many people say that, for example. I've seen in absentia, while absent. There's all sorts of intriguing terms that we use over and over again. Post-mortem, after death. Prima facie, on first view. Lawyers throw these terms all over the place there, and sometimes we're a bit bewildered. What are they saying? But it just shows how much Latin has entered, especially law, but also Reformation thought. And in education, once you've got a little bit of Latin, you've actually got a head up on quite a few other people deciphering things, making sense of it.
I have no idea how much Latin has infiltrated law, if you will. I mean, it makes so much sense, but like pro bono and quid pro quo. I mean, we all know those phrases, but you know what they mean, but I didn't realize that
yeah.
They're actually speaking Latin.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing.
Now, of course, we could do another class at some stage on Viking words. Viking words have infiltrated English a lot, like husband, wrong, die. I mean, these are Viking words. Woden's day, Wednesday. Woden's day, twig day, Frigg Day, our Friday, Thor's Day, or Thor. So four of our days of the week have been taken over by Viking gods' names, whereas before they used to all be the Latin Roman gods. So, of course, Saturn day, and then Sunday and Moon day for Monday. But they used to have all the other kind of planets, gods as well in the Roman. So the Vikings took four of the 7 days of the week's names over and left three of the Roman ones. It just shows again that there was the Roman influence, there was the Viking influence. Something like even window or anchor. I mean, these are Viking words. So again, to see the influence, a lot of English is Germanic. It came straight from the Saxons. Some of it's Celtic. And, of course, the Latin has a significant amount of influence. The Vikings had a huge influence as well. But to understand the roots of it, it really gives you a better appreciation of our language and also why you go to other countries and you find where we've got commonality or not. So, other thoughts or comments? Just look at these Latin abbreviations we have continually. You know, like, you wonder why it is D-Lit. Well, a doctor of literatum, BSc, Baccalaeus Scientiae, BA, Baccalus Artium. We use AD, Anno Domini, fair enough, AM in the morning, ante meridiem, and of course PM, post meridiem, that's past midday. So, yes, we called rest in peace, but it was requiescat in passe. Vox pop or vox populi, vs, versus, totally Latin. There's a huge amount of our abbreviations that just come from Latin that they take for granted. And the average person wouldn't know what is. If you ask a person to, you know, what does AD, AM, PM stand for? And the average student would be in trouble. Then the Christian influence in our society, just think of something like you look for an ambulance and it's got a pole with a serpent around it. In a veterinary surgery, they've got a pole with a serpent around it with a V over it. Where does that come from? So I've asked some of these medical graduates from UCT. I think it's from when they used to use the leeches for medicine. So it doesn't look like a leech. It looks like a serpent. Yeah, I guess so. Maybe it's the worms. Worms. Oh. And no, it's from Moses, Numbers, as Moses lifted up the bronze serpent on a stake to symbolize Christ who died on the cross. So it's extraordinary how our Christian heritage has been, in many cases, people are a bit confused, like, where does goodbye come from? God be with ye. Old Saxon greeting. Other questions, comments, observations? Well, here's a few other interesting ones just thrown. Ergo, therefore. This whole idea of vox populi, the voice of the people. Vox populi, vox Dei. The voice of the people is the voice of God, they said, which it isn't. Status quo, existing state of affairs. Circa, around approximately, when they don't know the exact date, you see that quite often. So, there's quite a bit that we can add, and there are some books. I've got the notes for this. So, Latin phrases and words. You'll notice on the back there's some of the Latin phrases. We've got some of the Latin books that we've got at the mission on the back. And I see that Nick has put quite a lot of the different books on Pilgrim's Progress and English literature and Latin on display by the window. Any other questions or comments? This is a lovely painting which comes from Switzerland and it's in Lausanne in the Palace of Justice. And Lady Justice is lifting up the scales of evidence and she's pointing down to an open book which has written on it, Holy Bible. So the elders of the city look up to the principles of justice who weighs the evidence and points to the principles of scripture while the sheriff stands with his double-edged German longsword waiting to apply justice and the merchants argue their case amongst one another. Justice lifts the nations, it says in Latin over the top. Any other questions or comments? got notes. Principles of law, especially. It's these biblical concepts that built civilization.
Yes. Where did the blind, deaf, and dumb thing come from?
It's terrible. I don't think that's biblical. You'll notice that's more American, because in Europe, all the lady justices I've seen in Britain, Germany, Switzerland, and so on, they don't have a blindfold. They can see. And interesting that, generally speaking, in America, I see the justice has the sword pointed upwards. And Europe too. But in America, they're always blindfolded justice. They want a blindfolded justice for some strange reason. But in Switzerland, the idea of the sword pointing down to the open Bible, that's one of the best depictions I've seen of what justice really is. That's just a magnificent scripture. And it's a huge, huge portrait in the Palace of Justice in Switzerland, that you've got to walk past things like that before making your judgments. It's so telling and meaningful. Good. Any questions, comments, either for me or for Andrea, on any of the points that have been given so far?
Shakespeare, how do you think he was influenced
at
all by Tyndale or not
by Shakespeare? Well, in that, the Geneva Bible was a lot of Tyndale's work. They even say that today about 90% of the New Testament of the King James is still Tyndale's work. So he was definitely influenced by Tyndale, because Tyndale's work influenced the Geneva Bible and the KJV.
I think that's modern English, isn't it? Tyndale's work is modern
very much.
English,
so. Well, a lot of people assume that in Shakespeare you're getting him quoting the KJV, but of course he is before the KJV. But the KJV continued so much of the same phrases that came from Tyndale through Geneva Bibles.
So kind of Tyndale did lay the foundations of modern English, actually.
Without a shadow of a doubt. Mm-hmm. But definitely Shakespeare built on it and made it very poetic and very much. For most of the people, you can imagine, most people wouldn't have had much education. And the plays were about the only place they learned about history, in many cases, which is why often at a historical event. And that was the main form of entertainment. So people learned from church, and they learned from the plays, and that was about the main way. And if they had a book in their home, it was maybe the Bible. And then later on, because of the Elizabethan era, people start to also have other great books coming available. Well, Fox's Book of Martyrs definitely would have been popular. And then later, after Shakespeare, then Pilgrim's Progress as well, joining in. But Shakespeare would have been the educator of many of the people of England.